From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
On stage tonight, Jerry's going to go, "Who out there believes the evolution is real?" And you'll hear the whole crowd roar, because now people, they see it all around them. They see it everywhere from the White House on down to all the doublethink and all the parallels to 1984 that exist in the world we live in.
Have we been fooling ourselves? Are we de-evolving instead of evolving? That's what the band Devo thinks. We'll hear more about Devo's theory of de-evolution today as we look at humanity's progress, or lack thereof. Also, the race to discover the earliest members of the human race.
In an intense cutthroat race where people are working in extreme circumstances, and these are the harshest environments in the world, who survives?
And the new scientific theory of evolution: intelligent life is the architect of the universe. Ray Kurzweil is one of the world's leading inventors, thinkers, and futurists. He's been described as the restless genius and the ultimate thinking machine. And Kurzweil says that we are all on our way to becoming thinking machines. Literally. We're on the verge of a new era in evolution, the singularity, in which computers the size of blood cells will be implanted in our brains. The title of Kurzweil's new book says it all. It's called "The Singularity Is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology." Kurzweil told Steve Paulson what we can look forward to.
We'll have nanobots, blood cell-sized devices that have powerful computers in them and communication devices. It'll all be on a wireless local area network. They'll be on the internet, and we can have billions of them in our brain. Today we have neural implants. In fact, some of them are programmable from outside the patient, like the FDA-approved Parkinson's implant. But these have to be surgically implanted. We'll be able to send them in without surgery, and not just to one spot in the brain, but to billions of locations, and have them interact with our biological neurons and really evolve into a hybrid of biological and non-biological intelligence by the late 2020s.
So what does that mean if we are, in a sense, hooked up to the internet just constantly all the time because we have this technology implanted in our brain? What changes at that point?
Well, some people feel we're already there, but we do have to interact with our computers, which for the most part are outside our bodies today, but they're going to make their way inside our clothing in a few years. I'm already working on one project like that, and ultimately inside our bodies. There are already early examples of this, but once we can build computers that are the size of blood cells in the early 2020s, they'll be interacting with our bodies and brains to vastly expand human intelligence. Now, one thing it's important to understand is that once the non-biological intelligence gets a foothold in our brains, and you could say we're at the early stages of that, where there's a dozen different neural implants, basically computers in people's brains that are surgically implanted today for diseases like Parkinson's. But once we're doing that on a wide scale, that non-biological portion of our intelligence will double in power every year, not because it's self-replicating, but just because that's the nature of what I call the law of accelerating returns. And that's been going on for a century and will continue. Our biological intelligence is basically fixed. By my calculations, we have 10 to the 26th power calculations per second among all the human brains in the world, and that'll be the same 50 years from now. But by the 2020s, we'll achieve the crossover point, and in 2030s, the non-biological portion of our intelligence will be much more powerful than the biological portion. And by the 2040s, I put the date for the singularity at 2045 because at that time, the non-biological portion of our intelligence, the intelligence of our civilization, will be a billion times more capable than the biological portion.
Now, when you talk about all of this intelligence, I mean, becoming millions or even billions of times more intelligent than what the biological brain is today, are you basically talking about the computational power of the brain? Or are you talking about all kinds of things? I mean, other kinds of neural capacities.
Okay, good question. If we talk about human intelligence and the human brain, and particularly human beings as we exist in our civilization with all our knowledge and skills, is the best example we have of an intelligent process. And we can identify both hardware, computational ability, and software, which is to say the methods, the principles by which we can recognize patterns or display emotional intelligence or solve analytical problems and so on. In order to achieve human levels of intelligence, so-called strong AI, strong artificial intelligence, we need both the hardware and the software.
So you're talking about computer artificial intelligence that shows love and happiness and all of those very human emotions.
That's right. All that takes place in our brain. Our emotional intelligence is not something sort of stuck on the side as a sideshow. It's actually the cutting edge of human intelligence. Being funny, being jealous, expressing a loving sentiment, these are very complex, sophisticated behaviors. It's actually the most intelligent thing that we do. But we will ultimately understand that. To come back to the hardware and software, we will have hardware platforms that are powerful enough to run human brain level processes if we can understand what those processes are. And that's actually pretty well accepted, that the hardware will be there actually by 2020. In fact, they'll be there in supercomputers by 2010. So the real key issue is, will we have the software? Because it's not my position that just having powerful enough computers, powerful enough hardware, will give us human-level intelligence. We need to understand the principles of operation of human intelligence, how the human brain performs these functions. What is the software? What is the algorithms? What is the content? And for that, we look to another grand project, which I label reverse engineering the human brain, understanding its methods. And we see the same exponential progress we see in other fields, like biology. I mean, the Genome Project, we doubled every year the amount of genetic data we sequenced. It took us 15 years to sequence HIV. We sequenced SARS in 31 days. And we're making similar exponential or accelerating progress in understanding the brain. The spatial resolution of brain scanners in 3D volume is doubling every year. The amount of data we're gathering on the brain is doubling every year.
Well, suppose this future comes to pass, what you've just laid out, and we're in the year 2050, and there are all of these super smart people roaming around. How does life change at that point, and what's different?
Well, it's going to go through several stages. We will go through a stage in the 2020s and 2030s where we are putting these intelligent nanobots in our bloodstream, which will keep us healthy from inside, augment our immune system, provide dramatic gains in human life expectancy, and then expand our mental functions. We'll still be human-like, but we'll have these mental prostheses. Now, some people might say that search engines are already a memory enhancement. I certainly use them. In fact, I may be on interviews, and I'm sitting there on my search engine and looking up facts in real time. And one woman said that her son's computer may as well be in his brain because he carries it around with him all the time. And so this will be getting more intimate. These devices will be inside our bodies and brains, expanding human capability. But over time, and because of this exponential growth, that non-biological portion of our intelligence will ultimately predominate. And we'll have human-level intelligence that doesn't have a physical body in real reality, but we'll be able to project bodies in virtual reality. We'll be spending more and more time in virtual reality. For example, if you want to go in virtual reality, the nanobots shut down the signals coming from your real senses, replace them with the signals that your brain would have been receiving had it been in the virtual environment. And to your brain, it feels like you're in that virtual environment. It can be just as realistic and compelling as real reality, incorporating all of the senses. You go to move your arm and your legs, but it moves your virtual body. So if your real body, your virtual body doesn't have to be the same body you have in real reality. Design of new virtual reality environments and new bodies to inhabit those environments will be a new art form. You can go there with one other special person or 100 people, from anything from a conference to an intimate encounter, and have these virtual experiences involving all of your senses.
Does the physical body become irrelevant? Does it become an anachronism?
Well, we don't abandon old technologies immediately. People didn't throw their manual typewriters away when the first clumsy word processors appeared, but it's hard to find a mechanical typewriter today. We didn't throw our horse and buggies away when cars emerged. In fact, cars were pretty crude when they first emerged, and we tend to keep these old technologies around.
So the body, the human body, you're saying, will become an old technology going the way of the typewriter.
Eventually, we'll be able to create human body version 2.0 and 3.0, going beyond the limitations of biology, and also spending increasingly more time in virtual reality environments. And, like any other technology, virtual reality at first will have some limitations, will be crude in certain ways, but eventually it'll be just as realistic and compelling as real reality, but have the advantage that you can choose from a million virtual reality environments, and some of which would be fantastic environments that, you know, couldn't exist in real reality. And you can have different bodies. You know, a couple could become each other to experience a relationship from the other's perspective, or a teacher could assign a student not just to dress up as Ben Franklin, but to be Ben Franklin in a virtual congressional congress. So there's applications for relationships, for education, certainly for entertainment.
Now, of course, a lot of people are appalled by this scenario. And part of what bothers them so much is it seems like you're redefining what it means to be human. And I'm wondering if you see it that way.
My definition of being human is we are the species that goes beyond our limitations. We didn't stay in the ground. We didn't even stay on the planet. We have not stayed with the limitations of our biology. When our genes were evolving, it was in the interest of the species for not that many people to live past child-rearing, which generally meant like age 28, because there were only limited resources, and those are best used by the young and those caring for them. In 1800, human life expectancy was 37. Mozart and Schubert died in the 30s, and that was typical. There was no sanitation, so people got bacterial infections. There were no antibiotics. There were no social safety nets. Human life was very hard. In many ways, Thomas Hobbes described it well as short and brutish and disaster-prone. And so we've gone, you know, way beyond those limitations already. And that's the whole thrust of this notion of progress in science and technology. We're now mastering the information processes underlying biology and reprogramming biology. I mean, that's a long discussion, but I believe in 10 or 15 years, we will reprogram biology to overcome all the major diseases that kill 95% of us. You know, I've got a lot of examples of how that's happening, but we can turn genes off with RNA interference, for example, and that wasn't feasible a few years ago. And the progress starts out very slow, but then explodes as we begin sort of doubling these very large numbers. And it applies not just to computers, but to our understanding of our intelligence, our understanding of our biology. And ultimately, we can master those processes and go beyond their limitations. No other species does that. No other species has a knowledge base that they pass down from generation to generation. They may teach certain genetically prescribed skills to their young, but they don't have a knowledge base that itself evolves. Our knowledge base is doubling every year, and we need our technology to encompass it.
Ray Kurzweil is the author of The Singularity Is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Evolution is in the news a lot these days, but what about de-evolution, the idea that humanity is actually regressing instead of progressing? That's the pessimistic concept behind the new wave band Devo. Devo was one of the most successful new wave bands of the late 1970s and early 80s. The band is currently on tour again, spreading their musical message of de-evolution. To the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon caught up with Devo's co-founder, Mark Mothersbaugh, backstage in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Greetings, beautiful mutants, and how may we be of service? This is Neutra for Devo Incorporated, checking in with the many factions of devolutionary humans who have waited so faithfully this past year while Devo gathered its strength for the next offensive. As many of you can see, the road ahead is filled with danger. It's not nuclear bombs we must fear, but the human mind itself, or lack of it, on this planet.
Jerry Casale and Mark Mothersbaugh met as students at Kent State in Ohio at the end of the 1960s. They were there when the Ohio National Guardsmen killed four students protesting the Vietnam War in May 1970. Casale was 15 feet away from one of the students who was killed. Mark Mothersbaugh says that the Kent State riots had a direct effect on Devo's worldview, the idea that humanity is not getting better, it's getting worse. Devo's philosophy is summed up best in their song, Jocko Homo. They tell us that we lost our tails. Eat all the apples from little sails. I say it's all just wind and sails. Are we that bad?
We are Devo.
Are we that bad?
Devo.
Devo co-founder, Mark Mothersbaugh.
I had a pamphlet called Jocko Homo, Earthbound Inheritor of Ape of Heaven. In it, it talked about de-evolution and talked about evolution being impossible, and Darwin went against all the tenets of religion. And so we were able to appropriate a lot of information from people like Jehovah's Witnesses that would come around, and they would constantly rail against evolution. We were just trying to come up with some sense to what was going on around us. We saw technology manifesting itself as nuclear reactor problems, people getting poisoned by pesticides and just all the chemicals that we were like dumping into the atmosphere. It just seemed to us, you know, with everything that was happening, you know, the economy in our hometown, for instance, we just saw everything adding up to de-evolution making more sense than evolution. I think one of the other places where we were really good at not realizing mistakes we were making early on was that people in the United States lack of being able to grasp ironic humor. Something that was pretty straightforward and simple would get us in fights. People would go, "You calling me a monkey?" And they'd get really upset. "You guys have a really bad attitude saying that things are falling apart, that de-evolution is real." Somebody recently just told me that they have video footage of us playing at a biker club where the bikers started tearing up the club when we were playing Jocko Homo, and they were going, "You calling us an ape?" And they're
basically behaving like apes.
Yeah, actually living up to the song, or down to it, actually. Yeah. But just being a lightning rod for hostility with people that were that wrong, I felt like we had to be doing something right, and so it was inspiring in a way. That was 25, 30 years ago. Now, on stage tonight, Jerry's going to go, "Who out there believes the evolution is real?" And you'll hear the whole crowd roar. Because now people, they see it all around them. They see it everywhere from the White House on down to all the doublethink and all the parallels to 1984 that exist in the world we live in.
The way the world is now, it seems to me anyway, Mark, that Devo is more relevant and timely now.
Unfortunately. Our intention wasn't to be correct. You know, we would have liked to have been proven wrong.
Okay, let's go!
Devo's fashion sense is probably best described as industrial chic. Matching yellow jumpsuits and red flower pot hats. And they move in a herky-jerky way, as if they're robots whose batteries need recharging. One of Devo's greatest songs is actually a cover version, quite possibly the coolest cover version in music history, their deconstruction of the Rolling Stones classic, I Can't Get No Satisfaction. Mothersbaugh explains what led to their robotic reinterpretation of Satisfaction.
We were rehearsing back in like 75 or 76 in Ohio, and we had some friends who had a car wash. Of course, in the winter, it's too cold to use a car wash, so this guy had a place where he stored the chemicals out behind it, and he let us rehearse in this room. It was just a cinder block room with no heat. So we were all in there, and it was like about, it was below freezing, you know, there was a lot of snow. We had to drive through the snowy car wash to get to this place. And we're standing there, and, you know, we have, like, gloves and coats on, and we're playing. And Bob Gasalli started playing that kind of, like, Persian, goose-steppy guitar part that starts it off, and everybody just kind of started filling in parts, you know, with frozen limbs, and somehow the lyrics all of a sudden made more sense to me than they ever did when we were in there, and I just started singing those lyrics over top of it, and it made everybody laugh.
I can't get me no without
Devo's biggest hit in the U.S. was their 1980 song, Whip It. Why Whip It?
I don't know why Whip It hit big. I have no idea. Maybe people like Don. You know what I think it was? I think it's just because of all our songs, it was the one that disc jockeys misconstrued as being about sex in some way. We'd be sitting in a radio station waiting to go and talk to DJs in the next room, and they go, whoa, I got Devo here. And I got to say, I whipped it just this morning. And then they're all in there laughing, and I'm like, oh, you pinhead. Nobody really knew it was actually about Jimmy Carter.
Correct that whip. Give the pass a slip. Step around where it. Break your mama's back. When a problem comes along, you must whip it. Before the cream sets out too long, you must whip it. When something's going wrong, you must whip it. Now whip it.
When we wrote it, we'd just come back from tour where people were bitching about Jimmy Carter all over the U.S. and even Europe. They were saying his foreign policies suck. He's always fluctuating. He doesn't take a strong stand on things, and he's not a good leader. Yeah, we wrote a song, Whip It. It was kind of like a Dale Carnegie, you can do it kind of thing. But I mean, on one level, that song was like our dumbest song because everybody got into it as a disco song. People would say, it's such a great dance song. They'd all dance to it, and most of the people that were listening to Whip It, they didn't even know about Jocko Homo or other things we were writing before that, or even on the same album.
What is Devo's legacy?
I don't know. I think our attempt was to permeate the culture on a number of levels. And that was a conscious goal on our part. And in that sense, Whip It accomplished some of the things we were trying to do that we didn't accomplish with other songs in the U.S. We wanted to set ourselves apart from pop music, but yet at the same time kind of move into that territory. We wanted to occupy that territory, but yet gives people something new to think about and something new to listen to. And we purposely chose uniforms that were not the uniform of the day. People go, oh, you guys all dress alike. We go, there's 20 of you there all with blue jeans on. You're all dressed alike. What are you pointing at me for? You know, at least we made up our own outfit. You're wearing somebody else's stupid outfit. You know, even now I still meet people who go, yeah, I got my ass kicked because of you guys, you know, when I was in high school. You know, I hear that so much. It became a pejorative term, even, Devo. Whether we had anything to do with it or not, they'd say, you're a Devo, you know, to the person that was slightly different at school, and then they'd get their ass kicked by the jocks and the in crowd. And so we did become kind of what we wanted to be, which was like a thinking man's kiss. At our best, we were that. We were just saying, use your brain. You're capable of so much more than just mindlessly buying the rap and letting someone else tell you how to live your life. Question everybody, especially authority, and choose your mutations carefully.
We'll be right back.
Mark Mothersbaugh, one of the co-founders of the band Devo. He spoke with, to the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon. If you'd like more information about Devo and Mark Mothersbaugh, you can find links to their websites on our website, ttbook.org. And this is Devo's own easy listening version of their hit, Whip It. Coming up, we'll find out all about the blood, sweat, and dirt involved in the race to find the missing links between humans and apes. And we'll explore the new scientific theory of evolution, which sees intelligent life as the architect of the universe. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Ann Gibbons is an award-winning science writer. She's been the primary writer on human evolution for Science magazine for over a decade. Gibbons is also the author of The First Human, The Race to Discover Our Earliest Ancestors. What inspired Gibbons to write about a group of international teams obsessed with solving the mystery of human evolution?
I went to France to profile a man named Michel Brunet, who found what is now the oldest known fossil, oldest potential ancestor of the human family, a beautiful 95% complete skull that lived in what is now Chad 7 million years ago. And Michel Brunet, when I got to France, was 62 years old, and he said to me, "I'm poor, I'm French, I'm crazy, and I'm a socialiste." And then he got in his Mercedes. I thought, this man's story is going to be very interesting. And he did not discover this fossil until he was in his early 60s, after a lifetime of searching. And he was then just one of four teams that had been in a very competitive race. This is a very cutthroat field. And the human stories were so thrilling, I couldn't sleep at night thinking that this is an amazing book. I have to tell these stories of the people and their quest.
You know, what I think is so surprising to those reading the book is to discover how competitive it is. It sounds as though these are all scientists. They all have a common goal. They ought to be working together somehow.
Yeah, just like
you laugh.
Completely. It's just like high-energy particle physics, human genome genetics, White House politics. Whenever there are scarce resources, i.e. fossils, in difficult places that are hard to get access to, with governments that are not always easy to get permits, there's intense competition for these resources. And so in a way, it's a little bit like natural selection at work. The people that survive in this field, in fact, for me, that was a key question. In an intense cutthroat race, where people are working in extreme circumstances, and these are the harshest environments in the world, who survives? You know, what does this say about human nature? That was a subtext of what I was writing. I had heard John Irving, who's, you know, many of you know probably as a great novelist, speak, and he said when he writes a book, he thinks about, you know, who survives in the worlds that he creates? And I thought, my goodness, that's a perfect way to think of these people that I'm writing about. Mm. What does it take to survive?
So tell me a little bit about the people. Who is it that you followed as they pursued this goal?
I followed four teams. One was Michel Brunet, who I told you was the French paleontologist, who is tremendously charismatic and fascinating to follow. He found the fossil that is almost 7 million years old. And then I also followed a team that works in Ethiopia, Tim White, who is an irreverent Californian, brilliant, irascible, doesn't mince his words when he doesn't like what his colleagues are doing. His team, which includes a number of Ethiopians that he has trained, work in Ethiopia, and they found fossils almost 6 million years old, between 4 and 6. I followed Meeve Leakey, who's fascinating. She married Richard Leakey into the famous Leakey family of fossil fame. And as Richard Leakey would say, he was famous and the only paleontologist on the cover of Time in the 70s. She's the better scientist of the couple. She loves working in the field and found a fossil that was 4 million. And then the fourth team were a little bit outsiders that came in at the end. Martin Pickford, British-born Kenyan, and his partner Brigitte Sanut, a French woman. And they came in and began working at an American site in Kenya. And that caused great waves because the American accused them of stealing his site. Oh. And lo and behold, they found a fossil that was 6 million years old. But those were the teams.
You've described them very well. I guess the other thing that we need to know is exactly what is it that they were pursuing? The fossil evidence of a hominid?
Yes. And these, you have to remember now, I'm writing not about creatures that look like us. As Tim White said, you would not invite these fossils to dinner. They look more like chimpanzees, although they are not chimpanzees. These are hominids, or sometimes they're known as hominines. The defining character of the earliest members of the human family at the moment is that they walked upright. But their brains were the size of chimpanzees' brains. They probably stood around 4 feet, the size of a small chimpanzee. They probably spent most of their time still in the trees and forests. That's a new discovery in the last decade. Not out in the open savanna yet. This is before stone tools, before language, before most of the behaviors we think of as human. But they were walking upright, and that is only... habitual upright walking is only found in the human family among all the primates.
Just, I hate to appear stupid, but how do you tell from a fossil whether it walked upright?
Especially a skull, right?
Right.
You know, if a headless creature walked upright. Well, you can look at the shape of the bones. If you're lucky enough to have leg, ankle, toe bones, you can tell an upright walking creature's bones because of the way the weight has to balance over the foot, has a different shape. It curves in a different way. You can cut open that bone or take images of it from the inside CT scans and look at the way the weight was distributed and see if it was standing upright, which is what has been done with leg bones. A skull is a harder problem. You can look at the angle, the hole where the spine comes into the base of a skull. Where it sits can tell you if it sat directly atop a spine or if the spine entered from the back of the head like a chimpanzee or other creature that walks on all fours or knuckle walks. So there's a lot of science, yeah.
Well, when you find the evidence, when the scientists find a fossil, the first thing they have to do is try to prove that it is not just another chimpanzee.
Exactly. An ancestor. Now, you have to remember, chimpanzees have been evolving 5 to 7 million years as well. Our ancestor separated from the ancestor of chimpanzees. So chimps that are 4 to 7 million years old don't look just like modern chimpanzees either. And that is the big question. Are all of these fossils members of the human family, extinct lineages, you know, types of ground apes? Was there a radiation, a bunch of ground apes running around? Are they ancestors of chimpanzees? This is the debate about these very early fossils or ancestors of gorillas. So they're all looking for more. Michel Brunet is looking for leg bones now, of course, to go with his skull. He'd love to find that or other members, other jawbones, to prove that this indeed was a hominid. Mm.
Do each of these teams have different approaches? I mean, in addition to being in different places, Brunet was in Chad and Tim White was in Ethiopia, the others were in Kenya. Did they have different ways of searching for these hominids?
Well, there is an art to searching. There's a standard way to do it, but each team puts their own interpretation on it, and talent makes a difference. In Tim White's team, for example, there's a man named Johannes Haile Selassie. And Tim compared his talent to somebody who plays the piano and has perfect pitch. He can look in a landscape of rubble or stones and see its pattern recognition. You know, these guys will train in camp. The Leakeys used to have their workers look at the bones they were looking for the night before to kind of get this pattern recognition going. And often it's the Africans that find the fossils best, perhaps because they are able to see things in the landscape they grew up in better. So when you then get someone like Johannes Haile Selassie, who's curator of human evolution at the Cleveland Museum of Natural History now, who went to Berkeley, when you get someone like him who's a PhD, who knows the fossils, can recognize any part of the anatomy with even small bits of bone, and he's working in his own landscape, it's a powerful combination.
Yeah. Now, the essence of this story is about these discoveries that were made really sequentially in the mid-1990s. After years of no discoveries, all of a sudden, bang, 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 within, what, about 6 months of each other, there were three discoveries?
Yes, well, 94 was the first one, 94, 95, and then there was a series in 98 and 2000 and 2002. So it wasn't within months, but it was within a couple years, things coming fast and furious, pushing back, back, back.
Yeah.
And there have been other discoveries since then, but nothing older or earlier. There are some other skeletons that are being uncovered that are around 4 million years old, which will be very exciting to flesh out these species.
Which was the first of these discoveries, the one in 94 or 95? Which team was that?
Tim White and the Ethiopians that work with him, and they're his co-equals, so I hate to keep saying Tim, but Tim and Johannes and Berhane Asfaw and some of the others. And that was Ardipithecus ramidus, which we keep hearing will be published in total probably in the next year or so. That concludes a very crumbly skeleton, partial skeleton, but it should show us what upright walking looked like around 4.4 million years ago.
Wow, 4.4 million. Now, that seems a long time ago, but within a couple, three, 4 years, it was pushed back further, right? 98?
Yes.
And who was it in 98, and what did they find?
Well, his own team found something 5.8 million years old, but it's mainly just teeth and some other bones of a very closely related fossil, they think, that's a lot like that. Then Martin Pickford and Brigitte Sanu found a thigh bone that's 6 million years old in Kenya, and I went there. And this thing looks like it was walking upright. They think it's a new type of human ancestor. That's under debate. Is it the same thing that other people have found? We don't know, because they don't have overlapping body parts to sort that out. And then in came Michel Brunet and his team with a stunning skull between 6 and 7 million years old in Chad, which was mind-blowing because everything else had come from East Africa, the Rift Valley. And suddenly we're talking about Central Africa. So these things were ranging far and wide, you know, early on.
I suppose the first reaction of the other teams must have been, oh, baloney, he didn't find anything in Chad.
I think there was some of that. Brigitte Sanut and Martin Pickford said, oh, it's just an ancestor of a gorilla. It looks more like the ancestor of a female gorilla. So there is some of that that happens. It's hard to know until full analysis has been done. And there are tremendous, this isn't just finding treasures. The analysis that starts is years and years of worth of work, imaging the fossils, reconstructing them, putting them back together, making sure the reconstruction's complete, and then saying, what does this anatomy show us about the way upright walking evolved? Did somebody stand up and walk upright a lot like a modern human right away? Or where there's this funny kind of weird walk in between, like, you know, Monty Python, Minister of Silly Walks or something. How did this upright walking evolve, you know, and why? Was it, you know, someone said to me, was it to dance or, you know, what drove that? So these are the kinds of things. They're looking at the pace of brain development. When did the big brain start expanding? These are the questions that are being asked of these fossils as they look at them carefully.
Ann Gibbons is the author of The First Human, The Race to Discover Our Earliest Ancestors. Coming up, is the universe fundamentally organic rather than mechanical? And is it in the process of coming to life? James Gardner thinks so. We'll hear from him next as we conclude our Hour on Humanity, Past, Present, and Future. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. James Gardner is not a scientist, but he is an accomplished science essayist and complexity theorist. He's the author of Biocosm, The New Scientific Theory of Evolution. Intelligent life is the architect of the universe. Now, Gardner may be talking about intelligent design, but he is not referring to God. And Gardner's theory may sound out of this world, but he's earned the approval of Sir Martin Rees, United Kingdom Astronomer Royal, and Paul Davies, Professor of Natural Philosophy at the Australian Centre for Astrobiology, among others. Gardner told Steve Paulson about his new scientific theory of evolution.
There is an element of design, of life friendliness, kind of built into the process from the beginning, from the very moment of the Big Bang, that pregnant within the dimensionless constants of physics is in fact an evolutionary plan, an ontogenetic plan, if you will, much like a plan that prescribes the future pathway of cosmological evolution in much the same way that DNA prescribes the future pathway of ontogenesis in the terrestrial biosphere.
Now, this is an enormously controversial idea. I mean, basically, that somehow, once the Big Bang happened, there was all this design that was going to lead to where we are now. It was inevitable, in other words.
Or if not inevitable, certainly highly probable. I mean, it's always hazardous to draw analogies from terrestrial evolution, but we obviously know that things can go wrong in the ontogeny of an organism. So I would say highly probable, perhaps inevitable, but at the very least highly probable.
Going to where? I mean, you're talking about highly probable that once we had the Big Bang 14 billion years ago, that life would evolve, intelligent life even?
Yes, precisely. That's precisely my hypothesis.
Now, and now you're not only treading into the terrain of physicists and cosmologists, but also evolutionary biologists. I mean, you know, first of all, you have to get to the origins of the Earth, and then you have to get to life evolving, and then you have to leap from that to more or less, you don't like the word inevitable, but nearly inevitable progress towards intelligent life.
That's correct. And it is a inherently perilous undertaking, I would agree, to make all of those leaps. And yet, I think that's the approach that's necessary if one is to begin to address in a cogent and systematic way what Brian Greene, the string theorist at Columbia, called the biggest and deepest question in all of science, which is, why is the universe life-friendly? You have to encompass within your analysis not only physics, but evolutionary biology as well.
But this is a minority viewpoint among biologists. I think if you were to ask most evolutionary biologists, was there anything, I mean, it gets into this whole question of the direction of evolution, and I think most biologists would say, you know, it's a random process, the way genetic mutations play out, and human beings are a lucky accident.
Yes, that I would agree that's the majority viewpoint, but there's a pretty strong minority viewpoint represented by people like Simon Conway Morris, for instance, and even in some of his writings, E.O. Wilson, mm-hmm. writings for which he was soundly criticized by the late Stephen Jay Gould.
And we might add, Richard Dawkins, the renowned atheist.
Exactly so.
Now, this sounds like a teleological argument, the kind of thing that theologians love but scientists hate, that there is some endpoint, some final destiny for the universe.
Well, be that as it may, I do believe that the argument has a telic dimension to it, a teleological dimension to it, but that's in keeping with my concept that in essence, the universe is in a process, not to be too literal about it, but a process of coming to life.
Well, spell this out for me then. Why do you think that, to put it simply, that we're living in an intelligent universe, a universe that almost demands that life be part of it?
Well, because I think that under my theory, intelligent life has a very specific functionality, and its functionality is essentially to serve as a kind of reproductive organ, a Xerox machine, if you will, to facilitate the replication of future generations of similarly bio-friendly universes.
Wait, let me break this down. You're saying that somehow universes will self-replicate and will generate other similar universes that are also conducive to life?
Yes, that's exactly correct. And if we can sort of take those one at a time, the notion that the Big Bang was not a one-off affair, that there is a process of what physicists call eternal inflation, that's really not controversial anymore. That's mainstream thinking represented by people like André Lindt, for instance, or Vilenkin, and even Alan Guth.
This is the idea that not everything just started with the Big Bang, that science doesn't end with the Big Bang, but you can actually talk about possible causes to the Big Bang. What came before the Big Bang?
And what will come after, in the sense that the theory posits that there are multiple Big Bangs going off all the time in inaccessible regions that we cannot observe, so that it wasn't simply a one-off affair. In fact, it's called eternal inflation. It's been going on forever. It'll continue forever. So that part of my approach is not in any respect novel. It's the canonical viewpoint. What is certainly novel is the idea that the process can be artificially manipulated, that you can somehow, in effect, engineer or glom onto that process and shape it in a way that it will propagate universes that are more like the one we're in right now than others that might have no chance to harbor intelligent life. That is controversial.
It sounds like you're saying that human beings, if they're sufficiently, well, if they're smart enough and if they're technologically advanced enough, can create new universes.
And in fact, that's precisely what, not human beings, but our distant progeny, sufficiently evolved intelligence in the far distant future. We certainly don't, but at least we don't appear to have that capability right now.
I want to get back to the question of how a universe could be created, and especially by our descendants, these super smart, technically wired people of the future. How would they do this?
Well, there really are two parts to that question. The process of essentially copying eternal inflation is about to be attempted in Japan, and simply requires the focusing of an intense amount of energy. And I assume that they're going to use a juiced-up laser of some sort to do this, the focusing of an intense amount of energy in a very small space to create what is called a false vacuum state, which presumably, when it decays, will pop out of our space-time continuum and create a new universe, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So that's step one of
okay.
the process. And we're, you know, like as I said, I'm totally amazed to see that somebody's going to try to actually run this experiment in 5 or 6 years. The second and more difficult question is, how could you possibly not only do that, but do that in such a way that you will have essentially a heredity mechanism, that you will be able to transmit to that new cosmos the life-friendly qualities that prevail in ours?
Right. I mean, you're talking about somehow setting up all those laws of physics that are
yes.
present in ours. I mean, you know, with the force of gravity, I mean, all these cosmological constants we've talked about, somehow if you're going to create a new baby universe, you've got to put all that into that new universe.
That's right. And I've actually written about that in a couple of essays and in a new one that I'm working on right now. But remember, come back to string theory. And remember that there are all of these possible manifestations, all these variations, 10 to the 500th power variants on the universe that we inhabit. So that whole menagerie is out there essentially as a palette with which you can paint the colors of a new cosmos. Now, how on earth do you choose? How do you sort of dip your brush in there and start painting out your own preferred version of a universe?
Why would they want to do that? I mean, why go to trouble
yeah.
to create this new universe?
I get that question a lot. And André Lindt has a paper in which he says maybe it's just a physical hacker's fantasy because you can. But it's a lot like saying, why do organisms on Earth go to all the trouble of reproducing? One sort of cynical explanation is because they've been kind of programmed that way by evolution. Mm-hmm. They've been programmed to reproduce. And I think something similar to that is probably the correct answer here, that if I'm correct, that impulse to replicate is sort of built into the process.
James Gardner is the author of Biocosm, The New Scientific Theory of Evolution. Intelligent Life is the Architect of the Universe. He spoke with Steve Paulson. To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1015B, Humanity, a Work in Progress. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan and Strange Champs, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.